From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In his first words as President of the United States, as if still on the campaign trail, Donald Trump described a country in ruins.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities. Rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation.
Even Trump's optimistic plans for redeveloping our hellscape were rife with darkness and foreboding.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
A decree, he said. Democracy has no decrees. America first, he said, echoing the isolationist and fascism-friendly movement of the early 40s. Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. On Friday, opened a new act. It's billed as patriotic, whether also lawful and democratic, remains unanswered.
Even as President Trump intoned those words from the podium, the WhiteHouse.gov website was being populated by a half dozen top priorities. First, to eliminate the government's climate action plan and revive the coal industry. Second, to defeat ISIS and rebuild our military. Third, to create jobs by cutting taxes and regulation. Fourth, to rebuild the military. I know, that was also number two. Fifth, to reduce crime by supporting gun rights and building a border wall. And sixth, to pull out or renegotiate our trade deals. No surprises there. No specifics either. What is a little surprising is that a show called On the Media hasn't yet focused on what President Trump's loathing of the media means for journalism. Time's a-wasting, so we'll start by recalling his slapdown of CNN at last week's press conference.
You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking
terrible.
Our news organization.
The media were none too happy with the experience, and apparently neither was the president-elect.
Trump threatened a blow to the White House press corps.
Thank you very much.
Maybe moving the briefings and maybe journalists' workspace across the street.
They are the opposition party. I want them out of the building. We are taking back the press room. That's a quote from a report in Esquire magazine.
Is he going to move them to the EOB from the press room?
He sure is. Absolutely.
Is he really?
Is that
right?
That's,
wow.
That's big.
Shocking. Until a few days later, at least, when Trump declared that, out of the goodness of his heart, he would allow the press to remain where they are, for now. But if he were to move the press corps, would it be as shocking as it's been portrayed? Time magazine's Olivia Waxman says, meh. With the help of the Time archive, Waxman traced the path of the White House press and found that it never did run smooth. Olivia, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the very beginning. What was the press-government relationship at the founding of the country?
Journalists were not allowed to attend the Constitutional Convention, nor were they allowed in early state legislatures or the Continental Congress. Actually, a gossip columnist named Anne Royale literally had to steal John Quincy Adams' clothes to get him to grant her an interview. She sat on his clothes on the bank of the Potomac until the bathing president granted her an interview.
Was there anything that really jumped out at you as surprising when you went through the archive of Time magazine?
Well, I was surprised that women had been the first to argue that everything in the White House should be public knowledge because taxpayers paid for its upkeep.
Emily Briggs of Philadelphia.
She said, "When we go to the executive mansion, we go to our own house. We recline on our own satin and ebony."
And then we get to President Grover Cleveland. And you say that's when we begin to see the emergence of the White House reporter that we'd recognize today.
Right. So there's a historian named Martha Kumar who pinpoints it to Fatty Price of the Washington Evening Star. He was one of the first reporters to work the White House beat. He sat at a table in a hallway and would pepper people with questions who were walking by. Martha Kumar found a letter that Fatty Price had written, a White House staff member saying, thank you for the tablecloth. So that seems to be the first sign we have that reporters were camped out, so to speak.
We're talking there the 1880s, 1890s. You get to the 1900s, to Teddy Roosevelt, who really loved reporters.
Yes, he had a sort of newspaper cabinet that typically would meet with him during Roosevelt's early afternoon shave. And if you can imagine, reporters got that kind of access in the early 20th century. Enviable now. But Teddy Roosevelt did banish reporters to what he called the Aeneas Club if the stories proved to be embarrassing for the president. And Fortune magazine reported that the journalists would readily forgive him because he made, quote, such astounding copy.
Roosevelt had his favorites, whereas President Wilson seemed to open up his doors to a wide range of reporters, a lot of people, less intimacy.
Yes. Wilson's private secretary, Joseph Tumulty, told reporters that the president would, quote, look them in the face and chat with them for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. So on March 15, 1913, 125 newspaper staffers showed up, and Wilson said, your numbers forced me to make a speech to you en masse instead of chatting with each of you as I had hoped to do, and thus getting greater pleasure and personal acquaintance out of this meeting.
Now, FDR, like his relative Teddy Roosevelt, was catnip for the press. He gave, you write, nearly 1,000 press conferences almost twice a week.
Time reported that he kept most White House news hawks fluttering happily. Those press conferences were ones where they had a real exchange of information. It was being compared to Prime Minister's Question Time in the UK. But he also locked the doors so no reporters could walk out.
Of the press room?
Yes. On occasion, he would call correspondents liars or tell them to put on dunce caps.
Really? I guess it's okay to call a particular correspondent a liar if it's not being televised. But that's when the next big change happened, under Eisenhower.
That's a watershed moment. James Hagerty, Eisenhower's press secretary, had been on the campaign trail. He had worked with the press corps before. He knew what a difference the press made. So January 1955 was the first televised news conference.
With the president.
Yes.
Well, I see we're trying a new experiment this morning. I hope it doesn't prove to be a disturbing influence.
Well, tomorrow, the second anniversary of your inauguration, I wonder if you'd care to give us an appraisal of your first 2 years and tell us something of your hopes for the next two or maybe even the next six.
Looks like a loaded question.
They were thinking about it in the same way that Trump thinks about Twitter. This is our chance to get to the public directly, to be seen by the public directly.
But Hagerty edited the thing. It wasn't in the control of any TV network.
Right. And the New York Post was surprised at how scripted this was. I'll quote from that article. What is most notable in all the comment is the absence of protest over the censorship imposed by the White House, a censorship which the networks have supinely accepted. Thus, after Wednesday's conference, Hagerty deleted 11 of the 27 questions and answers before letting the show go on the road. For example, when asked about his delay in the reappointment of Ewan Clegg as Commissioner of Labor Statistics, the president confessed he had never heard of the fellow.
Now, when you described LBJ's relationship to the press, in a way it kind of reminded me of Teddy Roosevelt's shaving. And you note that Johnson was pretty unceremonious as well.
Oh, yes. A White House reporter said that he once answered reporters' questions about the economy aboard Air Force One while stripping down until he was standing buck naked and waving his towel for emphasis. Johnson just didn't have any boundaries, apparently.
So bringing us closer to what's probably the Trump mindset, it was President Nixon who gave the press corps their current home. But he wasn't thereby doing the press any big favor, right?
Right. He wanted to keep presidential visitors and White House staff away from reporters. To designate a briefing room by putting a floor over the White House swimming pool. And when it opened in 1970, the Washington Post said it looked like the lobby of a fake Elizabethan steakhouse when the stage is hidden behind the curtains. And Ronald Reagan's press secretary, James S. Brady, for whom the briefing room is named, used to joke that he and Reagan always planned on installing a trap door so reporters who got out of line would fall into the swimming pool if he pushed a button on his podium.
In tracking the changes over centuries, do you notice a general trend?
Presidents may tweak the format of things as they come into office, but there were questions when Eisenhower came in whether to keep reporters in the White House. And Nixon thought about not having a press secretary at one point. But ultimately what happens is that presidents and their staff recognize that having 100 reporters and TV cameras and photographers in one place, this is a great resource. My favorite quote about precedents these days is from a special assistant to Calvin Coolidge, who said that if you can get the president to do a thing twice in a row, then every other president will do it.
I think the same could probably be said of the White House press corps. Olivia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Olivia Waxman writes for Time magazine.